Up next on episode 59 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff sit down with Damian Katz to discuss unconventional databases, unconventional programming languages, and taking on unconventional programming projects from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley. Today I'm excited to bring you another great program from Stack Overflow with Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood here on IT Conversations.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Stack Overflow.
Unless somebody drops the F-bomb or something crazy.
Right.
All right. Boom.
So should we introduce our guest, Damian Katz?
I think we should.
Of CouchDB fame.
Hello?
Yeah. That was a very authoritative intro, Damian. What? That's great. So yeah, thanks for agreeing to be on the show. And then we should give a little bit of background about Damian. And actually, one of the reasons I've known Damian, well, known is a very loose term, but I sort of discovered his blog like a long time ago. Gosh, back in 2005. When did you start your big adventure, Damian? When did that? What was the timeline for that?
I think it was around 2005 that I think it was 2004 when we decided. And I think it was 2005 when we actually moved to Charlotte.
Yeah, so I kind of discovered you right at the sort of near the beginning of your journey. And at first, let me tell you, I was very angry with you because this was at the time I was reading your blog, I was at a job where I had to work with Lotus Notes every day because it was our email system. So I was like, oh yeah, I found this developer. I hate this guy. I hate this guy. He worked on Lotus Notes. And so it was a way for me to sort of take out my corporate rage on you. But then I felt bad because you were actually kind of a nice guy and kind of an interesting blogger, and so I grew to love you, I think is what happened.
You know, you're I get that a lot about, you know, people with their dislike of Lotus Notes, so I'm always kind of nervous, you know, about that, to say, well, you know, it's I don't want to dump on it, you know, because I worked hard on it. A lot of people work really hard on it, and it's the way that it is for a reason, but I also know that it's also in kind of big bloated mess, and I understand your frustrations.
So. I want to go out on a limb and say that Lotus Notes rocked for its era, and that the reason people hate it is because they were forced to make it do things that it couldn't do because it had been sold at the enterprise level with all kinds of, you know, Lotus salespeople.
Yeah, I sort of think it was a little bit ahead of its time. They had to invent so much stuff.
Yeah, I mean, imagine like the web didn't exist, right? So you couldn't
But proper networking, the internet.
Oh, right, right. You couldn't even assume TCP/IP because that wasn't yet.
I don't think they supported TCP/IP in its first version. But they had to write like all their own modem drivers and stuff like that.
Wow.
So that PCs could dial into servers to replicate. And
I remember once getting into Bankers Trust a day after somebody had accidentally emailed a gigabyte file using Lotus Notes, which Lotus Notes then tried to synchronize to all the Bankers Trust sites around the world, completely saturating their transatlantic cable in the middle of the trading day and making it impossible to do trades for about 24 hours.
Yikes.
They were very upset about that, but they were really just using it. I mean, they were just using it as email, and there were some databases that a few people had built, but for a lot of the companies that installed it, it was just sort of an email system.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too much about Lotus Notes.
No, let's not. We want to talk about CouchDB.
Yeah, well, I was going to have a transition point there. And actually, there's this presentation Damian gave, CouchDB and Me, at Ruby Fringe, which is excellent. I'll link it from the show notes. But I found it very inspirational. And Damian, knowing a lot of your story, this gave me sort of the missing pieces to fill in. I sort of had bits and pieces of the story. But hearing the whole story from you was great. And I really, that was a great, great talk. And one of the transition points that you put in was, that I liked, was like you had worked with Lotus Notes, and there were things in Lotus Notes that were actually good ideas that were kind of being buried under sort of loads of crap. Yeah. And your idea was to take the good stuff from Lotus Notes and leave all the crap behind. And that's a feeling that I think anybody that's worked on a large system has that feeling of like, there's some good stuff in here, but it's just, there's so much annoying bad stuff that comes with it that if only I could start another company, take the really good stuff and just, you know, concentrate it and distill it down to something really awesome, I'd have a really good product. And I think that's what you did with CouchDB, right? Was like the good stuff.
Well, you know, when I started off on what I was going to work on, it wasn't going to be what CouchDB is now. And, you know, at the time, Lotus Notes, you know, and it's not a very sexy thing. It's kind of old, and, you know, a lot of people have very strong feelings against it. And so it's like, it's just not sexy. And then to come up and finally say, well, I'm not going to do something sexy. I'm going to do something that's like Lotus Notes, was a hard decision, but it was a great decision. Like I was kind of chasing after a lot of other things that seemed hip at the time and you know, wanted to do something with RSS or whatever. But I don't know. I just decided, well, I'm going to take this old boring thing and kind of spruce it up. And, I don't know. Now it's turned into the new sexiness. So I don't know how that happens, but, you know, at the time I really didn't think that it would, you know, catch on like it did. I thought that maybe I could get the Lotus guys interested in it and the rest of the world would just kind of ignore it, but it's actually turned out to be the opposite.
So, it's a database, it's a document database, and it's got the ragged right edge or whatever that, what's the term I'm looking for? Is that like every row can be a different.
Ragged well, right. Schemaless?
Like every row, huh?
Well, it's
schemaless.
It's schemaless, right. So,
every row can have different, columns in it, essentially.
Columns. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we call them documents, right? Because there is no concept of rows. There is within the view engine, but the database itself is just like a big bucket of documents.
Mm.
So you can consider each document a row. And they all have an ID associated with them. So, and that's unique across, all instances of the database. So you can have also replication, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
So that's very much like the same. That's the same, kind of very much the same as the engine in Lotus Notes.
In right. So Lotus Notes is the NSF database is basically the same design. Mm-hmm. You have a big bucket of documents, and each one has a name associated with it. In Lotus Notes, you can't set the names there, and they're GUIDs. But in CouchDB, you can name it any string, and if you don't name it, CouchDB gives it a name, which is a GUID.
Mm-hmm. And Erlang, what's this about Erlang? I hear.
So Erlang. Erlang has been fantastic for CouchDB. So far, the total lines of source code, production source code in CouchDB is under 12,000 lines.
Wow.
And most of that is Erlang. And, of course, that's not including some of the other projects that we include in our source control.
Right. But you've got Lucene and stuff like that.
Well, not Lucene, but maybe someday. But we have, like, a web server from a third party and a web client.
Oh, okay.
Things like that, but yeah, those are generalized libraries. They're not specific to CouchDB.
And what? Not a lot of programmers have ever seen or heard of Erlang. What? Erlang?
Yeah, Erlang. I don't know.
What is it? Where did it come from? What does it do? Why would you use this weird language?
So,
yeah,
what problem?
What problem did it solve for you that you had?
What problem did it solve for me? So. It's this idea of what happens when everything kind of goes to shit that really attracted me.
We should all be writing this then.
yeah. So as I was designing the core of this database system, and I was doing it in C++ at the time, and I was trying to figure out, you know, if this goes wrong, what's going to happen? How do I back out of this? You know, what happens when the shit hits the fan and trying to.
So this would be like networking errors, like.
Networking errors, memory errors. You just can't allocate enough memory to finish the operation. That's a big one.
Okay.
You might get a disk I/O error, but you know that's the sort of thing like you're allowed to panic and just give up at that point. You know, how to deal particularly with memory errors. You know, at any time you can just not be able to allocate memory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that? And it's extremely tricky. In C, it's all very explicit. So you actually can do it down to that level of, okay, if I don't have any memory, what am I going to do? How do I free my resources? Because you have to think about all that stuff anyway.
Yeah, and you're basically writing code to deal with that under every possible circumstance.
Right.
At every possible level.
And so, you know, coming up, designing all this, and I realized that there's just one problem that you can't get around without using relocatable memory, which is like using memory handles, mm-hmm. which is the memory fragmentation problem.
Right.
So if you're allocating raw off the heap and then you're freeing, any long-lived process, eventually the heap's going to get fragmented, and then you can't allocate any more memory. Mm-hmm. Or it becomes so fragmented that you're constantly having cache misses.
Mm-hmm.
And so dealing with those problems is really, really difficult in C. And if you want to deal with it properly, then you have to add another layer of abstraction where you have memory handles, you have to lock the handles and get the pointer. And
just like Win16 programming.
Right. And it's really, really painful, and you don't want to have to do all that. It's a huge productivity drain. But this is actually the area that Erlang handles great, because it doesn't force you to do a lot of error handling or checking or anything. What's the easiest way to describe it? You just sort of write the code like it's supposed to be, and it's allowed to blow up.
Okay.
You don't have to sit there and check for errors. And if it blows up, it's supposed to be in a nice little isolated process within the Erlang VM. And this isolated process, it doesn't have any locks held. It doesn't have any references to shared memory. And it can't be in an invariant state outside of its own process. It can't have... Well, it can if you design it poorly, but by default, it can't.
Hmm.
So if this process can no longer continue, it just gets killed, and then the heap gets freed, and then that gets freed back to the VM, and it's a nice big contiguous chunk. And if things start to get fragmented, things get slow, then more and more of these heaps can get freed, and then they can all be rebuilt. And so this idea that it's allowed to blow up, and then it'll sort of rebuild it back to the process state for you. Not exactly as it was, but it'll reinitialize. It'll say, okay, this thing is, this shit's hit the fan. Let's shut these components down and then restart them, and then hopefully things will continue. And if not, it'll actually start to restart more components.
So this sort of reminds me of like a web server that's running multiple processes on your behalf based on how many requests are coming in.
Yes.
And the only error handling you have is that a request can just, you know, return up 500. And that whole process goes away. And then there's some
right.
Teaming that's sitting there spinning up new processes for you to make up for all the ones that crashed and went away.
Right. So Erlang is very much, so that style of web server handling is like the Unix style of web serving. And
right.
Erlang is like the whole Unix ideal of isolated processes that can talk to each other,
mm-hmm.
encoded into a VM and made really efficient.
So are these processes short-lived, like to handle a single request?
Some of them are.
Even shorter than that? Or
yeah, some of them are. You just spawn a process to do some computations because you want to parallelize it, and you know, use your cores, and then they go away. So spawning a new process is like creating a new object in Java. It's super cheap. It's not like spawning a thread.
Or even like kicking off a process on Windows might be, you know,
a second
of wall clock time or something. Well,
right. That's like literally like a million times more expensive.
Right.
Creating an Erlang process is just a little virtual thing. It has a scheduler. Each process is, I think by default, like half a K, like 512 bytes or something.
Cool.
And then it grows from there, you know, as it uses memory.
And has the performance compared to, you know, C or C++ or
so
Java,
one of the,
or...
the interesting things about the performance of Erlang is that it's generally pretty slow when it's not heavily loaded. When you have like a single client, it generally loses in the benchmarks. It definitely loses to C, but it's going to lose to a lot of other languages like Java. And
is there something that's like interpreted, or is it like, is there a bytecode down there?
Yes, it is. And there's no reason that it has to be slower than Java or C sharp, even though it's an interpreted language. It's also got a JIT. It's right. Just it hasn't had the number of, you know, man years dedicated right. to optimizing it.
Right.
So what was I talking about? Oh yeah,
Performance-wise, it's you saying it was slow, like
right. So
with one process.
So these little processes, each process, it's not like a whole thread, which is much heavier weight. An OS thread is a pretty heavy thing. It's got a big call stack, which you know is can be up to a megabyte or more,
mm-hmm.
It's got all these hooks in the OS. I don't even know all the stuff that's in there, but they're far, far heavier than the Erlang process.
Sure, it's got a copy of the environment.
And so when you have threads and then you switch between threads, then like, for instance, that thread stack now has to get loaded into memory. Mm-hmm. And it has to get, when I say into memory, out of main RAM into the local, the L2 and L1 caches. Mm-hmm. In order to quickly access. So that takes a bunch of time, and that might actually saturate the whole cache depending on how much data the current thread is reading off of the stack.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's going to evict a bunch of things off of the stack. And then if you have a big shared memory environment, you might be pulling in another page just to read it one byte. But the way the modern OS, the modern hardware works, loading the from main memory, it's going to not just load that byte, but it's also going to load a big area around it.
The whole page or right. whatever, yeah.
And then it's going to have to evict some data. So, and that's fine when you have basically a single-threaded environment where you have all that stack and you don't have to swap it out. So in a lot of benchmarks, when you're trying to do something as fast as possible and you have a single thread, that's going to be the way, and you're not paying that price of constantly swapping it out. When you start to get a bunch of these threads, then you constantly have contention for not only the memory bus on different processors, but also each processor's local cache as you swap things out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Erlang, these processes are super tiny, and their heaps are really small.
Mm-hmm.
So when Erlang schedules a process, it doesn't have to swap in a whole call stack. It just swaps in the Erlang call stack, which is because it's tail call optimized. It's usually pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
And then it swaps in its heap for all of its data as soon as it's going to access something out of that. Mm-hmm. And the heap is also small. And as long as that process is computing and not messaging out, then everything that it's going to be doing is now going to be nicely in cache. And it's not going to have to evict a bunch of other stuff. And it's not going to keep hitting main memory for you know, wherever it is, something that's in another process.
So
when you do message another process, then that actually is going to often cause a cache page fault, and then it's going to have to load things into memory. But that's more explicit. Like within your programming, it's obvious that you're doing that.
So it sounds like Erlang is the kind of language you choose because you want to do specific – you want this particular multi-threaded behavior basically.
Well, right.
You want the cheap threads and the –
Right. When you want to support a bunch of clients and you don't want it to slow down because you know they keep connecting, Erlang is ideal because each client that it's servicing can be represented as processes or a collection of processes. And all the memory within those processes are much more tightly bound together. So they're much more cache friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of swapping stuff out of main memory into the caches just is much, much more efficient in Erlang when it's under load.
Got it.
And that's one of the big performance boosts that you see. You don't start to see good Erlang performance comparable to other things until you start to put it under heavy load where you're servicing a lot of clients.
Is it is this a language that where did this come from?
So this was they started it in the 80s. It was a project at Ericsson.
Mm-hmm.
They made
phone switches or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's designed for telecom. And it's designed for phone switches. And they liked this shared nothing architecture. They wanted the hot code reloading. Just a lot of things that were very specific to telecom. And they wanted to solve these problems and give themselves a tool that
mm-hmm.
did all these things nicely. And I don't know, it's got a checkered history. Like, it got kicked out of Ericsson sometime in the 90s. And and then they were going to rewrite all the airline code in C. And then I guess that they sort of abandoned that because they realized that was foolish. And I don't know. But yeah, that's its origin is telecom and Ericsson.
Cool.
Telephone switches.
But you didn't set out to use Erlang. I mean, you had a problem. You were like, how can I solve my problem? Was that the approach? I remember in your presentation, you said you read about it on Lambda the Ultimate or something.
Yeah, I think that's where I first read about it. But yeah, the first versions of CouchDB that I was writing were in C++.
And it was just backing out of all these error conditions was just so painful, right?
Well,
that was the motivation.
It was when I started getting into the concurrency aspects of it.
It was a thing where you're trying to scale, or
no? I was just trying to actually do serve more than one client at once. So I had the database engine working. But
you're trying to get n greater than one for the clients.
Right.
that's the first. That's a lot of work there. What did Microsoft Access have that DBase 3 didn't have?
Yeah. Well, no, we haven't actually gone past n equals 1 on web servers on Stack Overflow, and we're kind of dreading it because we do have some shared state. Not a lot, but some. I appreciate the significance of the problem, believe me.
So are you you were working for Lotus, and then Lotus got bought by IBM.
Yeah.
And now you're working for IBM again?
Yeah. IBM is... they pay me to work on CouchDB and to help them with their cloud computing stuff.
Cool.
And IBM has been really great.
But you get to work from home pretty much.
I get to work from home. I was really leery about joining because I thought they had ulterior motives that, you know, they were going to try to snuff out my project or something like that. But
who's got the energy to snuff out a project?
I don't know. I've had bad experiences with IBM in the past, but it's a huge company, and this is a different division. I just didn't know what to expect. But IBM has been fantastic, and
this is open source though. This isn't like a product at IBM. This is kind of a different thing.
But it sort of competes against their product notes.
Not yet. I mean, because Notes is a whole whole stack, you know.
Sure.
It's not just a back-end database, it's also a client with the UI and all these applications that are already built for it and everything. Potentially it is, because it duplicates one of the core aspects of their technology. But I'm trying to get them, you know, going on a hosted version of CouchDB. Trying to sell them on that, and
so they would make available a hosted version of CouchDB,
right, for a monthly fee.
Does anybody do that?
Right now, yes. Couch.io, Couch.io is a hosting provider for CouchDB, but they are invite only right now. And I think there's at least one other. I know there's at least one other startup that provides it, but they're in stealth mode, so I don't know if they want me to talk about them.
It would sure be a different world if IBM did something like this.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense on a lot of levels. So I'm working on it.
If somebody wants to build something on top of CouchDB, like they want to use it, I don't know. Let's say they're building a blogging platform, for example, and they want to use it. I mean, they could use a hosted version.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that mean that they're building their blogging platform on some other hosting platform, and every single one of their IO requests has to go over to the hosted CouchDB, or do they somehow run side by side or in process?
Well, so there's this thing called Couch Apps, where we can serve applications right from CouchDB.
Okay.
So you don't need any middleware at all.
What do you write them in?
It's in JavaScript.
Okay, cool.
So
the language of the future, JavaScript.
Server-side JavaScript.
Yeah, when we switched over to JavaScript, it was just kind of out of a practical matter, and because it's an available language that plays very well with JSON, and has a nice sandbox, and I don't know, and all of a sudden it seems like it's everywhere now. It's exploding, so I couldn't have made a better choice. I'm really not. I don't understand why all of a sudden it's becoming so popular.
Well, I think you the way I understood it is you finally hooked in JSON and JavaScript. I mean, you kind of hooked into sort of the popular, well, I guess popular is not the right word, but the common denominator language that a lot of people say, oh, I get that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not obscure. Well, it's just something you can, and I think in your presentation, I know I keep coming back to this, but I loved your presentation. You talked about how all of a sudden you're working in the browser. You had downloaded some JavaScript command line thing, and you were able to like insert data in the database in JavaScript, and all of a sudden it seemed real to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And I think that's probably the reaction a lot of people had, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that's unique. So I think when you say, why did it get popular, I think you got to think about how can we make this accessible to the average developer? And certainly running in the browser, having JavaScript just magically do stuff, I mean, that's pretty accessible. So,
well, I mean, well, to clarify, I'm talking about why is JavaScript suddenly so hot? Is my big question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part
because
of it is...
Because it's been around since, what is it, 96?
But it hasn't really worked until, like, 2005. When was the first time? I mean, because I know Paul Graham, his famous thing for Web 2.0 is Web 2.0 can be loosely translated as JavaScript now works reliably. You know, and that didn't really happen, honestly, until about 2005, 2006, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was a matter of getting rid of some of the cross-platform problems. Even just being able to access the DOM. I mean, the first versions of JavaScript couldn't manipulate the DOM. They didn't have dynamic HTML. Do you remember when all you could do is put edit boxes up and you could change those, but you couldn't, like, you know, hide a paragraph or something?
Yeah, and like you could throw up an alert box and that was like, wow, was that's like, amazing.
Yeah, and it sort of looked like a toy language to so many that it didn't get a, you know, it had started as sort of a, I guess, a scheme implementation.
Yeah, that's something I learned on the podcast was that the guy who created it was like a scheme guru or something.
Brendan Eich.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So it has some street cred.
Yeah, it's got that. It's got the functional programming. It's got the lambdas. It's got some nice stuff in there.
Yeah, I don't know JavaScript that well. It was just kind of dumb luck that I picked the right language.
Well, you know, it's funny. You said you didn't know SQL either. There was a stint where you worked for MySQL, and part of you mentioned like I didn't even know SQL. I was like, how could you be a developer and not, how did you get away with not knowing SQL until last year or whatever?
That I know blows that. My mind. It's also I don't know how to use a spreadsheet either. So those are like the two things.
You're going to
like,
make Joel cry. Don't say that.
Actually, there's just there's a difference between being a systems programmer and an application programmer. An application programmer has to know SQL and a systems programmer doesn't. And Damien is a systems programmer. You don't have to know Excel.
I started off as an applications programmer, but it was in the Lotus world. So that's why I had almost no exposure to SQL.
Yeah.
Now, another thing I want to comment on, Damien, is that you basically quit your job with the intent of building something. And
well, no, I think I didn't quit my job, but
oh, that's right, you were laid off.
I did stop looking.
Clarification.
Yeah, I did stop looking, and I did have some good leads on a job. I wasn't like unemployable or something, but
right. Now, just to clarify, sure. But I liked your particular quote here was that I didn't want to spend all my time at the office working on someone else's crap anymore.
Yeah, we'll work on my crap.
And I like that. And you know, when I met you, and again, I use the term met loosely because we had sort of interacted through the blog and sort of got to know each other. It was like I could see that you had this dream of CouchDB, but it was hard for me to interact with it because it was your dream. You know, it was like your thing that you were building, and it wasn't necessarily my dream, right? And that's not wrong, but it was just hard for me to hook into it. But I totally respected that you were out there saying, hey, I'm going to build something that I think, you know, has value, right, that I believe in. Like, I'm going to work on my own crap. And a lot of times when I try to explain to people like the whole Stack Overflow story, at some point you do reach that realization. It's like, are you going to build other people's stuff? Or are you going to build your own stuff? You know, at some level.
Well, after a while, you get tired of other people, you know, making it your success impossible, you know, or not impossible, but just making it harder. And, you know, you want some sort of degree of control and you want to be able to say, yes, this is, I made this and, you know, this is what it is. And I'm responsible for it. You know, I can't blame somebody else.
Right.
Yeah. No, so,
it was very, very inspirational. I mean, I love that presentation, and it really completed the picture for me. Another point that I want to talk about was, and I wonder, you know, I'm always telling people, you know, what a great book Code Complete is. And in your presentation, you said at one point, you know, you have analysis paralysis where you're working on your own thing. There's nobody telling you what to do. And then you sort of like reach a decision point where you're like, I can't decide what I should be doing or how I'm supposed to be doing this. There's nobody telling me what to do anymore. And now it's kind of like you don't know what direction to go in. And I believe the slide title was Panic. And then your solution to that was to buy a copy of Code Complete. And I'm just imagining the smooth, you know, calming voice of Steve McConnell, who actually does have a very calming Midwestern voice, very soothing, if you've ever heard him speak. And I'm just imagining you reading Code Complete 2 and being all calmed and smooth and saying, I do know what I'm doing.
Well, you know, I read the book, and I did. I remember just getting it and just feeling like instantly like I had, I don't know, like a life raft or something. Like I just wanted to hold it and say, yes, like something that can show me the way. And then I was reading it, and, you know, and everything in it made sense. And it's a good book. It has lots of really great advice. But, you know, the thing that struck me was how little new information I was getting from it. And I was like, yeah, I know this stuff. But, you know, where's the secret? And then, you know, I guess eventually I just realized, well, if this book were teaching me all sorts of new things that I didn't know, then I guess I would be pretty dumb for having done this, you know? And, so I don't know. It didn't really help me in that it gave me great advice. It helped me in that it just gave me confidence that, yes, I know that stuff.
Right. Well, that's great. And that's one of the things I love about the book is I keep going back to it. You know, I think it appeals to all skill levels. If you're a beginner and you truly don't know anything about what you're doing, it'll sort of give you guidance. And then if you're an expert, it sort of reinforces, hey, I actually do know what I'm doing. I'm not some loser who's just an idiot out here creating God knows what, but I'm actually a competent professional, right? Like, I know what I'm doing. And I love that part of the message, too. That was great. And then the final thing about the presentation, I know I'm going on and on about it, but can you comment on the douchebags line?
No.
Oh.
There was a meeting with IBM, so just take it away there, Damien.
No, So when IBM came knocking, and I wasn't really sure of their intentions, I sent this email that started off kind of nice, but I got angrier as I was writing it because I felt like somebody was trying to take away this thing I was creating. And, you know, I kind of had some antipathy towards IBM at that point, and it was just kind of coming out. And I said, you know, IBM's got a lot of douchebags.
And describe what you mean by douchebags, like the type of person who does what? What? Give me some examples.
Well, right. So then he asked me to change that line. He said change the language, and that was like the only thing that was really kind of bad language in it. So I changed that line. I changed it to vapid bureaucrats.
They're synonyms.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, it's not easy to tell who's who. You know, you get these guys who are really smooth talkers or whatever, and, you know, you think, oh, yeah, he's not going to fool me, but, you know, that's not been my experience. I can't figure out who's really competent and who's not. And, you know, that's basically the point I was trying to get across there, was that they have a lot of vapid bureaucrats and also a lot of really great people, but you can't tell the difference all the time.
There's an organization that large is going to have people that are optimizing for their local area rather than optimizing for the good of the company or the good of the world.
Right, and IBM is a huge company. I mean, it's close to 400,000 people, and it's all over the world, and it's in every niche. And there's no one way to characterize IBM. There's just not.
Right.
In some areas, they're absolutely brilliant, and in some areas, they're absolutely horrible. And in any company that size, that's going to be true.
Mm-hmm. But what damage specifically had these kind of people done to you in the past? Like, I just want some examples of, no names, obviously, but just your interactions with these people. How had they sort of caused damage to your project or you personally? I mean, like, what's you must have had something in mind when you said this.
Oh, yeah, this is going to get back to when IBM took over Iris. Let's just say that Iris, where I used to work on Lotus Notes, that was the company founded by Ray Ozzie, and was independent for a while and then owned by Lotus, which was then owned by IBM. And for a while, we operated still independently, even when IBM owned us. And then one day that stopped. And they came in and they said, oh, yeah, we're not going to change anything. It's going to be great. And we're just doing this to make it easier to work with other people within IBM so they can come over to your company and work and blah, blah, blah. And then they just proceeded to ruin everything that was good and unique about Iris.
So that was, but these are human resource professionals that have brought to do this.
You know, I don't know who they were. And, you know, they were, some of them were big wigs with, you know, British accents and funky suits.
But was it, was it fundamentally just a disconnect on the engineering side versus like management versus engineering? Like the just pointy headed managers just doing things that made no sense for the actual people on the ground, or?
You know, I don't know. At some level, I felt like, you know, they just don't know any better. And at some level, I just felt like they're just bullshitting us and they know they're full of it. And, so I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I still don't know.
It's just organizations. This is what big organizations do. Like there's somewhere there's a manager, and the manager is optimizing for managing the most number of people in the stablest possible group, because that's what optimizes for their career.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
So they appear to have some particular agenda, but their agenda is always just to grow their empire.
Well, you know, the kind of things that they told us about what wasn't going to change and what would change, that's the things that I don't know if they really understood what they were saying. They really understood what it was that they were going to change, or if they were just lying to us. You know, I can accept incompetence, but you know, it's
really
he's right. There's incompetence and there's malice, right?
Right.
They're kind of different things. So
I don't know which it was. So I have to give them the benefit of the doubt and just say it was incompetence.
Yeah. Hey okay. Jeff, do we have any Stack Overflow / server fault news for the week?
Some minor news.
Right.
We're kind of heads down working on some other features that hopefully will come out in the next, 6 to 8 weeks or whatever time frame that is.
Yeah.
I did build up two more servers that are going to be used for superuser.com.
Two more servers?
Yep.
Wait, so what do we have now? We have two web servers and a database server.
Well, we have a bunch of extra servers, basically. I would just rather have extra capacity because we rent rack space, so it doesn't really cost us anything to have these extra servers. Although I did have to run more electrical outlets. We did pay for more amps just in case.
Get enough amps with your rack?
Well, we do, but everybody wants to be super safe in the data center. They don't want to be anywhere near capacity. I'm a risk taker, so I'm like, yeah, just push it right to the edge. I don't care.
Well, what happens is that if they have a temporary power outage, when it comes back, everybody draws like three times as much as they're drawing at stable state.
Yeah.
It's like the computer to power up, but for some reason, these stupid computers turn on all six of their fans.
They're incredibly loud. When I was building these servers
just to power up, four times the power. Well,
let me explain. So we have a 3-month-old baby. So when I was building up these servers, when I powered on the server, it would trigger his Moro reflex. It was so loud. And this is in two rooms over.
His what reflex? Wait,
The Moro reflex is a reflex in infants where they sort of throw their arms out like they're falling. It's sort of a stabilization thing. But they do it when they're surprised or startled or they think they're falling. So it's actually kind of amusing. If you go to YouTube, I'll link it in the show notes. The Moro reflex.
In the show notes. And this is going to be a picture of your baby.
No. It'll be an actual YouTube video of someone triggering the Moro reflex in an infant. But that's how loud they are. Servers are incredibly loud. Okay. So you're right. I mean, at boot up, they will use lots of power because they got this turn on all their fans at full volume. It's just deafening.
Right. So the trouble is you need to be provisioned for that to happen to every server in the entire data center. You need to get one of these special PDUs that will turn them on one at a time when the power comes back.
Yeah. So, no,
Google
it's better
has
safe
it where,
than sorry. Absolutely.
Each server has its own battery backup, and maybe for that reason.
Have you heard
about that in their data centers?
No.
Each individual server has its own little UPS.
Oh, wow.
It's built into the chassis.
Interesting.
Oh, that's cool.
I hope the fire department doesn't find out about this.
So we have a grand total, since you asked. We have 6 servers, 5 1Us, which are inexpensive, actually. Mm-hmm. The 2U database server.
Right.
Our network-attached storage device, a switch, and I think that's everything. So that's all sitting at the data center. That actually arrived today, so Jeff's going to go down and plug in the 2 new servers. We also have the logo contest I talked about last week for superuser.com.
Yeah, we're going to launch SuperUser.
Yeah, the first thing we need for Super User really is the logo, because that kind of sets the tone for the colors we're going to use for the site.
Yeah,
because
then we can't make a t-shirt until we have a logo.
Or stickers. I mean, let's get our priorities correct here. But yeah, we're excited about the launch of Super User. So as soon as I get the logo together, I think things will go together pretty rapidly from there. And then on the Server Fault and Stack Overflow side, I think everything's chugging along.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working a lot with our community moderators. Remember, we chose we had a voting process, and we chose some Stack Overflow community moderators. And also, we sort of just ad hoc picked a few people on the Server Fault side, because that's a brand new site. There wasn't anybody to vote. And I've been really pleased. I've really enjoyed working with the community moderators. It's actually fun. Because a lot of times I'd made these secret decisions of, like, what should I do with this user? And I just felt like kind of a burden, because I was, like, the one guy making this decision about what we should do with these the occasional misbehavior that we see. It's not a real serious problem.
Now you get to have, like, a click.
Yeah, we get to have we get to talk about, like, is this the right thing to do? Is this not the right thing to do? And it's kind of nice to be unburdened of being the judge, jury, and executioner of these things that
it's
come
like
up.
It's like you're the vice principal, but now you've got student government.
Oh, it's so much better. I didn't really appreciate that until I did that.
Yeah.
So that's really it on the Stack Overflow side. Not a lot of news this week.
Good. Anybody got a? We got some listener questions. Maybe let's do some Stack Overflow questions.
Well, let's do one listener question really quick.
One quick listener question. All right. Yeah. We actually have a pretty good one. Let me find it.
Hey, Joel and Jeff. First, let me thank you for your podcast. My name is Mayan Keshet, and I'm from Israel. What is your stance about using open source software in production code when the open source project in question is working, but is either below 1.0 or is not actively maintained? For example, Joel mentioned using Lucene.net in Fogbugs, and while there are fresh commits to its SVN repository, the latest release is from April 2007. What would you say to customers who are afraid that using such projects will hamper stability? Thanks.
Okay.
So first of all, there's two pieces here. One is the version number is kind of an illusion, right? Particularly in open source.
You can make up any version number you want. So just because the version
like
number 1.0, is
1.0. What does that really mean? You know, I don't think you can look at the version number as a reliable indicator unless it's like 0.00001, right? Then you might worry, because it's like, okay, you're so far from one, you're scaring me now.
Right.
With your 0.001.
Right.
Beyond that, I don't think it.
Most
really
developers are reasonably responsible. Like, if they feel like their code is not stable, they'll not yet, you know, usable by anybody other than on an experimental basis. You know, a lot of developers will use a number below one, and then when they personally feel like it's gotten good enough, they'll move it up to 1.0.
Yeah, but I don't know if I trust other developers. That's one thing I've sort of learned.
Sure.
So, Damien, what would you say? What version number is CouchDB at?
We're at 0.9, but that doesn't mean that. But that doesn't mean that 1.0 is next. It goes to 0.10, at least before that. So.
And what's your philosophy on your version numbers?
So with CouchDB, we feel it's pretty solid as a database. Like, you're not going to lose your data. There's not going to be big catastrophic failures because of it.
What was the first version number you felt that was actually somewhat usable, that you would actually release into the wild? I was like, okay, here's this thing. What was that version number?
I've been working on this thing a long time. I can't remember the version number.
But it's also a sort of a general question of when you're using an open source component. I mean, I guess you're using Erlang, which itself is a little bit off the beaten path.
No, it's a good question, and
You guys use Lucene, right? As well,
yeah. And there's no good answer.
Yeah.
You know, we use a couple of third party libraries, MochiWeb for Erlang, which I highly recommend. I was concerned when we integrated it that it was going to be, you know, we're going to be fixing all their bugs, but for the most part, we've only we had a very small handful of patches.
And we had, Jeff, we had that thing in the WMD thing in Stack Overflow, where we basically had to reconstitute the source somehow.
Yeah, that was unfortunate. Damien,
stumbling block.
Well, it was a stumbling block, but it was kind of a painful one, because all we had was the minimized or minified JavaScript, which, you know, all the variables were like A, B, C, everything's all mushed together. And we had to basically reverse engineer it because the lead developer basically fell off the planet. I still don't know what happened to John. John Fraser was his name. Still don't know what happened to that guy. Have not heard anything from him for months and months. And we had some interactions with him, but we ended up having to just reconstitute it from scratch. So at least we had some form of the source. But yeah, that was painful.
What did you do? Did you just use a pretty printer and go from there?
We basically crowdsourced it. I mean, luckily there were a few people that pitched in. Somebody ran it through sort of a JavaScript prettifier to start. And then we had to just go in and basically look at all the code and like reverse engineer variable names and comments. And, you know, it's not fun to work with minified JavaScript as a production code base at all. So,
but it was just minified. It wasn't obfuscate.
Well, minification is kind of like obfuscation, though.
It is, but
it's similar. I mean, it's not the same.
Intentionally obfuscate it, can make it nearly impossible.
It's not. It's not malevolent. non-malevolent minification.
It's non-malevolent. So, but still, it was very painful. And Dana Robinson did most of the work on that, actually. So,
there's also sort of a question related to this one around using components. I mean, I guess I think I wrote an article about this once. The idea is don't use anything that you don't trust or you can't fix if it doesn't work. So if you have the source code, then at least you know you can fix it in worst case scenario. And if you don't have the source code, then you really have to have much higher level of trust. Like, all right, well, this is supported by Microsoft, and that gives you a higher level of trust because Microsoft usually doesn't leave you completely high and dry. You know, they won't leave you with a completely non-working component.
Right.
I think pretty close.
The question itself had some good guidelines, which is you want to look at the number of commits. I mean, is it
still alive? Right.
Yeah, is it alive? Are people actually working on it? And then beyond people working on it, how many people are using it? Like, let's say the code was totally stable. Say it's this piece of code that just hasn't changed in 5 years. Well, that can be okay if, like, hundreds of thousands of people are using this code. Does it really matter if it hasn't changed in 5 years? It must be working for all these people. So I think there's a third thing he's not talking about here, which is how many other people are actively using this thing, regardless of how many commits and how alive the code base is, because it could be totally stable.
There's also something I've learned to look at, which is that the velocity of a project is generally more important than where it is right now. So having a lot of critical mass, like if you were trying to make, if you're trying to use a relational database about 10 years ago, you had to decide between MySQL and PostgreSQL. And PostgreSQL was just better. It was just better in every way. But MySQL, for some reason, had a little bit more momentum behind it.
Sure.
And this is sounding like, you know, like kind of like Weasley or like something an MBA might say. But there was more work going into MySQL, and so it was getting better faster. And for a real long range project, that was something you had to look at.
Sure. I mean, actually, the same thing applies to CouchDB. I mean, if all of a sudden a bunch of people are using it, and there's the perception that, you know, it's the hot new thing, then it becomes the hot new thing.
Sure.
You know? And hopefully, it's based on actual quality in this case. But
well,
there's certainly truth to a lot of that.
Wins that we can't really talk about right now, but hopefully they'll be announced soon. We'll get some buzz off of that.
Can't be very announced. Cool. You mean there's some development team somewhere that's using CacheDB for something high profile and they're not allowed to say who it is?
Yep.
Aw.
Secrets.
Secrets. Sorry. But I can't say, we're included with the Ubuntu One. And that's going to be on 10 million desktops by the end of the year. That's CacheDB is going to be a central part of that.
Cool.
And Ubuntu One is the file synchronization and cloud backup and access.
So wow.
Store all your data and
so that's using CouchDB for the synchronization?
Yep.
No kidding.
Well, I think they also have other things that they're going to other data sources that they're going to synchronize, but CouchDB is going to be a major one of them.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And they're right now, they're paying some of the CouchDB. Well, they haven't paid them yet, but they're hiring some of the CouchDB guys to add some features that they need.
Cool.
So, Damien, let me get like the one paragraph description. Okay, I'm a software developer. I have a data problem. Which data problem? Like, how? what pieces of that data problem would make you say, hey, CouchDB is a perfect fit for what you're trying to do?
So the best way that I've come up with to describe what CouchDB is good for is if whatever it is that you're trying to do wasn't in the computer, if it wasn't, you know, in the web, what would it look like? And if it ends up being a bunch of documents that get routed around and filed away and signed off and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. then there's a really good chance that CouchDB is a good fit.
Okay, so the more loose the data is, where it's not like, okay, rigid set of columns, it's just a bunch of crap in a document.
Well,
the more it's like that.
It doesn't have to be loose. It's also, would it be documents in real life? So a contact database is a good example of that. In real life, you'd have your Rolodex, and each little card in there is a document.
What about like someone's resume? Would someone's resume be like, if you had a database of resumes, would that be?
Right, yeah. You could definitely store a bunch of resumes in CouchDB. And, then you can, do what all the HR professionals like to do and look at, the ones who have the most qualifications by the number of things on there or whatever.
The number of keyword
CouchDB
hits.
Would be good for, telling you who has the most experience.
10 years of experience with CouchDB.
Right. That's probably an easier question to ask in CouchDB than it is in a relational database.
Okay, cool. So, did we have any Stack Overflow questions? Now, I know Damien, I was nagging you about looking at Stack Overflow and picking a question that you liked. Did you see anything that you liked? Anything jump out at you?
Yeah. So, can I do transactions and locks in CouchDB?
Oh yeah, I just saw that one.
And let me, copy.
What's the number of the question at the top of the... So we can all look it up together.
I just pasted it into the Skype chat. So Joel can see it.
It's 299-723.
299-723. Okay, got it.
Who's this guy who's answering it? Mr. Kurt? Is he one of the developers on the team or just some...
I don't know.
No.
He looks like he works for Ars Technica. He doesn't work for CouchDB.
Cool.
They must use CouchDB, though, at Ars Technica, I guess.
Dun,
or...
We're starting to figure it out.
Okay. So,
maybe that's a secret thing we're not allowed to.
So this guy, he wants to run an auction site. He wants to have a direct purchase as well. In a direct purchase, I have to decrement the quantity field in the item record, but only if the quantity is greater than zero. That's why I need locks and transactions. I don't know how to address that without locks of transactions. Can I solve this with CouchDB? So specifically, the way he wants to solve this is fairly easy. You just, if you have an item record and it has a count on it, then you just load it up, you decrement it by one, and then you save it. If somebody else tried to save it at the same time as you, you'll get back a conflict error, in which case you'll have to reload the document because they might have changed the count. Then you reload the document, increment the count, and then save it again. And if you have a bunch of contention for that, then it's unbounded how long it can take, how many retries you'd have to do. But otherwise, that's how it works.
Wait, I got a little bit confused there. You have, if you don't have transactions, you could read it, and then somebody else could read it, and you could update it, and then you could submit your update. You could write your update, and then they write their update, and now you've each reduced it by one, but it's only gone down one.
Right, because one of you will get the conflict.
Right. Oh, you would get a conflict after you've read it before.
So whoever is updating second, whoever loses the race gets a conflict there, and their save doesn't happen. So they'd have to retry it, and that means reloading the document, getting that count field, and then incrementing it, and then saving it.
They got a conflict simply because they were writing after they had...
Right. So every time you load a document from a CouchDB database, it contains a revision number. It's like a unique ID that says this is a particular revision of this document.
Oh, I see.
When you save it, you have to send back that revision number.
Right.
And if somebody else has already saved over it, that's how it detects if there's a
conflict. Okay, cool. There are also, there are situations where there may be... In a relational database model, there may be situations where it's even more complicated than that. Like you're trying to write to something else.
Right. If you're trying to write to a bunch of unrelated data.
Yeah.
Then CouchDB is not going to.
It's not really set up for that.
It's not going to do that for you. If all the data can be contained in a single document, then there's no problem. You just update that single document and you get the conflict.
Does anybody ever try to use CouchDB like alongside a relational database and somehow try to bind records from CouchDB to the relational database, or would that just be like pain for no purpose?
I actually think I think somebody has done that, but I could be wrong, or it might have just been a suggestion.
Because, you know, there's been a lot of times relational database developers have this phobia of putting documents in the relational database, sometimes justified and sometimes not. And they'll tend to build these systems where they say, well, what we'll do is we'll put the large blobs or the large documents in the file system and a pointer to that file in the relational database.
Right.
And it all seems so simple to them, and that's going to be so easy, and disasters occur.
Well, yeah, I don't understand. I mean, I don't know specifically what makes relational databases unsuitable for large blobs. I don't think that they are.
Right, right.
I don't know why people have a phobia about that.
I don't know what they're imagining.
It might be they might have perfectly good reasons, but
like a Microsoft Access database that would really suck if you tried to put. I mean, you can put blobs in there, but it just doesn't scale,
right?
Because it's all going into one file, which is limited to 2 gigabytes anyway. And so I can see where the phobia comes from, but certainly with a modern version of SQL Server or Oracle or yeah, it shouldn't be a problem to put large blobs in there.
So, right. Damien, at the bottom of this question, somebody asked sort of another writer question, which was, how do you do the classic bank account example of a database transaction in CouchDB? That is, you want to atomically withdraw $100 from Alice's account and deposit it into Bob's account.
Right.
So, and there's millions of accounts. You can't.
This
you
is
know.
Actually CouchDB's strong point. This is actually like the perfect fit because if you were doing this as a real accountant with a paper ledger, they say accountants don't use erasers.
Right.
And so with CouchDB, what you would do is you don't decrement a person's account and add it to another person's account.
Right.
Instead, what you do is you have a single transaction document that says, I'm taking X dollars from Alice and adding those X dollars to Bob or maybe also Charlie. And that single document now represents that transaction. And then within CouchDB, use views to add up what somebody's account is. So you add up all their deposits and all their withdrawals and all their transfers, plus minus, and you do a reduction and you get, you know, what their account balance is.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, within the database, there's nowhere to update their account balance.
Yeah, the balance is not stored. It's calculated on the fly based on what transactions have happened.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I had an accounting lesson from Joel in person, so.
Do you remember that part?
Vaguely.
Double entry bookkeeping. It was a bookkeeping. Yeah. Bookkeeping, not accounting.
Bookkeeping. Sorry.
all right, I got a question. I want to do my question.
Sure.
I got a server fault question for the first time in history.
Ooh, exciting.
And
what's
it's
the number?
Number one. No, just kidding. It's number 23621.
23621.
Do we really have 23,000 questions? No, these numbers go up faster than the number of questions.
It includes answers as
right,
well.
Right, right. The question is not that interesting. Just the question is, this guy's running Windows 7. He's got a lot of RAM, and he wants to know if he even needs a page file. Can I just turn off the page file since I have as much RAM as I'm ever going to use? And but what's good about this is if it's got the world's best answer I've ever seen that just makes me appreciate server fault.
That's cool. I think every geek at some point goes through this thought process. It's like, I've got tons and tons of memory. Maybe
why
I can turn off my page file.
Right.
I actually have a blog entry about this. And so it's essentially the same as the answer, but the punchline is it's never worth it.
You have not thought about this nearly as much as the people at Microsoft. So first of all, the page file doesn't work the way you think it works. Like you were probably taught in Computer Science 101 that once in a while a file is swapped out. You know, you run out of memory and then it starts swapping to the page file.
Yes.
And actually what's happening is it's preemptively swapping to the page file. Secondly, a lot of things just live on disk, and they only swap into memory when they're needed. So, for example, an executable file for an app that you're launching just starts out on disk, and only the pieces that are used come in, and they can be thrown away instantly. They don't have to be moved out. They can just be dropped because they can always be reloaded later. And if the operating system is bored, it's going to use some of its spare time to move things out.
Bored.
Yeah. So that later, when it's not bored, when it's really busy, it won't. So anyway, so there's a good article about that. It's got a great summary in one line at the beginning. What does that stand for? TL semicolon DR. TL.
Too long. You don't know that?
Too long.
Didn't read.
Drop.
This is a great answer because he put the summary at the top, so you don't even have to read it, which is awesome.
Yeah, but what's TL?
Well, Q-U-U-X, which is unpronounceable even by me.
I'm going to pronounce it.
Great answer. And you, what a kick butt answer. Because he puts the best part.
Yeah, and this dude, Q-U-U-X, whoever he or she may be, it's just a stick figure in the drawing. But if you click through, he's got a website, right? That's visible to the public, not just to us, right?
Yes,
the website.
The website's public.
So he's actually got a really good blog here that's like a great system administration blog, which I want to recommend at qux.tumblr.com. Cool. He's got just a few posts that he had up that I saw on the homepage there are awesome. This looks like a really, really interesting and well-written website for system administrators. So
very cool.
Kudos to...
Great answer. And do not get rid of your page file.
Yeah, and it's just a general attitude thing. It's like don't be second guessing. You know what? There's a problem that we always had, and it's more common. I hate to say this, it's more common among Unix system administrators than among Windows system administrators, which is they get the thing out of the box, they get the operating system out of the box, they install it, and then they're going to want to do 47 things to that system before they can use it, mostly removing things that were put there that they don't understand.
Yes.
So they have an attitude that's like, what are all these services that are running? I'm going to kill all these services, and then my server will be really fast.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, you know, okay, it works for a while, and then you go and you install Foglugs, and it doesn't run because some basic service that everybody else has been removed, severely deleted from the operating system by some system administrator that thinks they know better or really doesn't.
You sound a little bitter about this.
I am bitter because it's all of our tech support calls. It's comes from people that are like, you know, there is generally a philosophy that security flaws often come from things that you don't even realize you have running, and that probably shouldn't be running. And you know, why do you need that? You know, it's the RPC endpoint service or something. Mm-hmm. You know, like let's just delete all these things and strip them down. And so making strip down systems is a lot of fun. On the Unix side, on the Windows side, you really should know what you're doing. And there are better ways to protect your system against random shit like firewalls. So, actually, Windows system administrators are just less apt to do this. And it's good to understand what your computer's doing.
Right. But there's a point at which you're interfering. You think you're
right.
There's a point at which you think you're smarter than the people who built the operating system, which is almost never ever true.
Right.
And there's a similar problem on the programming side, which is I'm smarter than the people who designed the language.
I'm gonna write my own malloc.
Right. I'm gonna write my own malloc, or I'm gonna do garbage collection right now because I know there's just way too much garbage.
Seems like a good time to do garbage collection.
We need to take out the garbage right now because it's really bothering me, and you need to do it now because I know what I'm doing as a programmer, and you don't.
Right.
Yeah, no, tread very, very carefully here. I mean, that's all I'm going to say is, like, generally, don't do it, and tread very carefully if you feel like you must. So.
And, you know, and if you're treading in one of those areas, you should be doing so because that's your area of specialty. That's something you're responsible for, you know? So, for example, if you're, if you're Erlang and you care about threads, then you should be obsessive compulsive about how you use operating system threads, operating system memory, and stuff like that, because that's where you're adding value, really, to the world.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and similarly, Damien, you were working on CouchDB, and so not getting fragmented in memory so that you can have long-running stable processes, especially with different size, lots and lots of different size objects, is something that you really had to get right.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know, you're going to muck around with that, but you're not going to muck around with, you know, oh gosh, I need a different 3D graphics library or something, or I'm going to make my own IDE. If you listeners, if you have a question that you would like to, oh my God, they brought pizza right outside of my office. Okay, show's over. Goodbye.
It's pizza time.
Wait, we got an announcement. Goodbye. Quick. First of all, Damien, thank you very much for being on with us.
Yep, thank you, Damien.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you on the internet besides couch, Googling for CouchDB? Do you have a blog?
DamienKatz.net.
Damien with an E. Katz, yes. With an A.
DamienKatz.
Katz. And that stands for Kohen Sadiq. To our listeners, if you have any questions, could you please call in the Stack Overflow podcast hotline? Now, this is a problem. I have to look this up. What is the phone number for that? I got a new computer here. I don't know how to look things up anymore.
It's a podcast hotline?
Yeah, people can call our phone number and leave questions, which we play on a future show, as we did today. Oh, yeah, here's the number.
I have the number.
Yeah.
I got it.
Go ahead.
It's 646-826-3879. Just call.
Or you can, just call that number, leave a voicemail, make it less than 90 seconds. Or you can record an MP3 or Ogg Vorbis file, which you can then email to podcast@stackoverflow.com. We have a transcript wiki, which is a contribution. Contributors from around the world all kind of go in there and transcribe parts of this podcast that they think are interesting to them to be preserved for posterity and for the benefit of the hearing impaired. And that will be linked to from the show notes, where you can find hyperlinks to all of the exciting events, World Wide Web hyperlinks to all the exciting things that we've mentioned in this podcast, graciously created by Jeff. So that's all linked to from the show notes at blog.stackoverflow.com. See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.